Good morning. Okay, let's begin this morning in the English version. This is the English version of our next study in James. We're looking today at James chapter 4, verse 13 to 17. James chapter 4, verse 13 to 17, because it's James, we'll read the King James. How about that? Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city, and continue there a year, and buy and sell, and get gain. Whereas, ye know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapour that appeareth for a little time, and then vanisheth away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live, and do this or that. But now ye rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good, and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Okay, looking at this passage, it's very similar to the next section. If you just have a quick look over at chapter 5, he says, go to now, you rich men, weep and howl, etc. And it ends with, what's the word? imploring or recommendation is probably a better word. Afterwards, let's just say a piece of good advice. Be patient, therefore, unto the coming of the Lord. So we have this phrase, go to now, which is obviously a phrase that doesn't really fit well in English. Go to now, ye that say, you know, what does go to mean in this sense? It's actually really a Hebraism. It comes from the Hebrew, haba, and it means come. Just to sort of get an idea what the background is. Remember, James is a Jew, and talking to Jewish people here, probably in its original context. Let's have a look just quickly at Genesis chapter 11 and have an idea of what this introduction signifies. So let's begin with verse 1. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Now, we don't call it Shinar, we call it Sumer, but it's the same place, different pronunciation. And they said to one another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime they had for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build a city and a tower, whose top may reach under heaven, and let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men had builded. And the Lord said, behold, this people is one, and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. And God says, go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. I mean, this is almost identical to what James is saying. We have the expression go to three times here. And so we can see the context is the same. And so James is drawing on the same Hebraic idea. The people say, basically, like, come and listen to me. Let's build a big tower up to heaven so that we can do whatever we want. And then they say that twice, and God says, come and listen to me. Let's go down there and stop it, so that they won't be able to do what they've imagined to do. So this is what James is talking about, going back to James chapter 4. Going back to James chapter 4, he's talking about people who boast in the same way as they did in Babel. Go to, now, you that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city, continue there a year, and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas you don't know what shall be tomorrow. And what is your life? It is even a vapor which appeareth for a little time, and then it vanishes away. Today I'd like to talk about this sin, which, you know what, in today's world, in this modern society, it's really even hard for us to acknowledge that this is a sin. You know, we're so filled with this in everyday life, more so than ever in this society, that it's kind of a shock even just to realize it's a sin. Like, how many times do we hear people talk about, you know, what are your plans for the year? Oh, I think I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do this. You know, I'm going to, you know, work for another couple of years, and then I'm going to get a house down the coast, and I'm going to just live a happy life, or I'm going to, you know, I'm going to move over to Thailand and do this. Or even today, you could work in a supermarket and still travel the world. You know, imagine that. Imagine 200 years ago, someone who worked, you know, as a servant in a market, he would probably never even get to leave his village. Today, someone who works in a supermarket can literally travel the world. They can literally do whatever they want. I mean, we live in such a society. Well, we do anyway. So it's very easy for us to commit this sin without even realizing that it is, in fact, a sin. So let's understand why it's a sin. The main point of this is that in our boasting and in our plans, we commit two sins. First of all, we forget that God is in control and pretend that he's not. And secondly, while we're pretending that God is not in control, we're running our own race, making our own plans without any thought for what God has intended for us. That's why it's a sin. Let me put it another way. Imagine someone, imagine I'm a father and I have a daughter who's, you know, ready to get married or at the age of getting married. And someone that I don't even know comes along and says to all of his friends, I'm going to marry his daughter. I'm going to move into his house. It's like, oh, really? Really? Or imagine, let's put it in another context. Imagine that you have a business and someone else that you don't know or someone that has no particular, you know, close connection with you, that person boasts and says, I'm going to, you know, become the president of that guy's company. I'm going to take it over and I'm going to change it and do what I want. You would be like, really? This kind of happened the other day with Twitter and Elon Musk, didn't it? You know, the people resent someone who just comes in and just assumes that they have a right to come in and do whatever they want in someone else's territory. You know, that makes sense. The other day, my friend applied for a visa to visit Australia, and he was shocked because they didn't give his wife a visa. And I was shocked too. It's like, what? You know, he's an Australian, and his wife only wanted to go there for a holiday with her husband from the Philippines, and he's a missionary. And I thought, that's crazy. But then after he started explaining the situation, they said in the application that she would be speaking in churches. And then I kind of understood, I see the problem. If you're going to come to Australia on a tourist visa, you're not supposed to be doing any, you know, particular work. It's supposed to be a tourist visa. On the other hand, if you came on a spouse visa, then you would probably have the freedom to do all of those things. Now, of course, missionaries worldwide can only be missionaries because they do things like that. But the point of it is, from the Australian perspective, if you want to come under certain conditions, you've got to fulfill those conditions. And it's, I guess, arrogance to them to just assume that you can ignore their conditions. Well, whether or not that's true in the countries and missions, it's certainly true with God. So what he's saying here is when we assume that we can just do whatever we want with our life, and we assume that tomorrow we'll still be breathing, even though it's God who holds our life in his hands, that actually is offensive to God. That's offensive to God. It would be like, you know, if I give $100 to, you know, a homeless person, and then the guy just talks about how I'm going to give him $100 every day for the rest of his life. It's like, well, wait a second. Maybe I did it today because I had it and I felt compassion. But, you know, you can't assume that just because I did it once, I'm going to do it every single day. It's like that. Now, James is probably drawing on some tradition here. Adam Clark points out that the Jews had a lot of stories that illustrate this point. I'll just share one with you. This is the story of a rabbi who was visiting Rabbi Simeon, and it's in the book called Devarim Rabbah, which means great words, really. But he talks about a rabbi who was visiting a family when their son had been born, and their father brought out wine that was 7 years old, very, you know, aged wine, very good wine. And he boasted how he was going to use this wine and celebrate for a long, long, long time the birth of his son. And on the way home, the rabbi met the angel of death. And the angel of death was walking around, and the rabbi said to him, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm the angel of death, a messenger from God." And the rabbi said, "Why are you walking around like this?" And he said, "I'm walking around waiting to slay those who make boastful, presumptuous statements before God, because the guy who said that he's going to celebrate for a long time the birth of his son will die within 30 days. So this, obviously, this is a story, but it teaches us the idea that God is very displeased with people who actually make presumptuous statements. And again, we all do this. I mean, I do this. We've got to understand that this is a sin against God. Okay? It's a sin against God because in making such statements, what we're doing is we're elevating our own will above God, and we're never considering the constraints that God himself puts into our life. A good example of this is what happened to me when I went to Vietnam the last time. I went to Vietnam, I was in Hanoi, and for, what was it, 3 or 4 days, maybe 3 full days, I was teaching a group of hill tribe pastors and missionaries and, you know, workers who came down from the hills to learn the Bible in Hanoi. And, you know, it was all a kind of a undercover operation. Obviously, these people had come at great risk to their lives because of, you know, doing mission work, and especially for the minorities is very much against the law in Vietnam. But as far as I was concerned, I had a great time. I had some interesting translators and, you know, lots of good questions. We talked about, you know, all of the things that I used to teach at that time, the Midrash and the Old Testament, understanding how the Bible works and whatever. And then after that, the incident happened with Moriel. And even though that was really nothing to do with Moriel, because I had actually introduced Moriel to them myself through people that I'd known for many years, that Moriel had obviously gone and, you know, told them that I was, you know, a false teacher and a heretic and whatever. And so when I replied to that group afterwards to see, you know, about the next schedule, because when I left they'd asked me to come back, you know, they just ignored my emails. So at the time I was very kind of, in a sense, offended, but in another sense, I guess ashamed, because I felt that, just a minute, what's this got to do with Moriel? It's got nothing to do with them. This is between me and them. It's nothing to do with you. And I was proud because, you know, I guess looking back, you know, here's me, the great missionary, teaching all these mountain tribe people, all of the, you know, the deep things of God. Pride comes up. And I think it wasn't so much the sense that I really wanted to teach these people more than the sense that I resented someone else getting in between me and what I wanted to do. You know what I mean? It was an issue of pride. I couldn't accept the situation that, you know, I was not able to do something because of someone else. And I didn't realize at the time that the whole thing was in God. That God had organized the whole thing. He knew exactly what was happening. He knew beforehand what was happening. And I'm sure he had multiple purposes in doing this, one of which being to humble my pride. But God is a God who has the authority and the power to rule the world and the universe, and he also has the authority to open doors and close them. But when we make these plans, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and we elevate our will, and then when we can't do it because of someone else's perceived interruption or intervention or opposition, then we get upset. And we don't recognize the work of God in this. You know, it would be like someone who wants to go into a concert, but they're too late and they won't let them in, and they're upset because they can't get in. But they don't recognize that there are rules about entry and exit, and, you know, if people came in at any time, they would interrupt the show. And so they get upset, but they don't recognize that they're not the authority in that concert hall. Someone else is, and that there are real reasons for the rules. So we have to recognize, no matter what we're doing, no matter what we're planning, no matter what we're hoping, that ultimately God is in control, and God has the right to stop us in our tracks. God has the right to take away every good opportunity that we thought we were going to get. God has the right to change everything in an instant. And so as we think and plan and speak, of course, we don't know what's going to happen. And so we can't just say, well, I don't know what's going to happen, so I won't plan anything. No, it's not about that. It's about our attitude as we do it. We very humbly make plans. We say, perhaps this is an opportunity. Perhaps it's something I'll pray about. It's something I'll look into. And then that's not just an expression. That's something we should do. It's something that may be a good idea. There's a big difference between that attitude and someone who just says, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And you might say, well, it's just a matter of words. No, it's not just a matter of words. It's a matter of attitude. And the attitude is here what God is judging. He's not judging the fact that people make plans. He's judging the attitude in which they make them. And then you take away those plans and you see the anger and the frustration in people, then you can see why the attitude was sinful, how the people didn't accept God's restraint in the situation. Another good example of this is Numbers. Let's have a look at Numbers chapter 14, and we'll read verse 45. Numbers 14 and 45. Let me bring it up here. Okay, just getting it up here on my screen. Numbers 14, 45. Okay, so this is talking about after in Kadesh Barnea, when God had said, send 12 men in to spy out the land, and they came up and gave a bad report. 10 of them gave a bad report, and God was angry at them and sent a plague as a judgment. And then Moses declared that, all right, God has decided that you will not go into the promised land until this entire generation, except for Caleb and Joshua, have died. So God just stopped them. He took away their plans. He took away their great opportunity. And even that was something God had promised, but then he changed it because of this, their rebellion, their sin. And 45 says this, and then they said, okay, all right, we will go up. Let's go up. It says verse 44, they presumed to go up to the mountaintop. Nevertheless, neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed from the camp. So they thought, all right, we're going to do it anyway. We'll just go anyway, despite what God had said. We're sorry. All right, I understand. All right, but now, okay, let's go. Let's do what God had originally said. But God had said, no, it's too late. I've changed my plan. That's off now. We're on to another plan now. Verse 45, then the Amalekites and the Canaanites, who dwelt in the mountain, came down and attacked them and drove them back as far as Korma. Okay, that's an interesting thing, because when they tried to do something that God had not ordained, they were attacked and driven back. They weren't successful. And it says that they were driven back as far as Korma. And Korma means devoted to God, or put to death, devoted to God. They were driven back to the point where they realized that they were devoted to God. You know, that they were given over to this by God. We have to realize that it's God who makes the decisions. When we have a red light, then we have to stop. Regardless of how much we think we should go, we need to stop. When God closes a door, we need to accept that the door is closed, and we can't force it open. We wait, and, you know, sometimes a door might have been open, but we missed it, and then it closes. Then it's closed. We can't force it open again. We can wait for God to give us a new instruction. We can try to understand what God is doing and the lesson He's teaching us through that. But we can't just assume that we can just go and do it again anyway. Now, there are times when God may call us again to do that thing, like with Jonah, for example. But we need to allow God to be the one to lay out His instructions before us. Interesting. Let's look at Deuteronomy 1:44. Deuteronomy 1:44. He talks about this same event. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 44, but we'll read from verse 42. Then the Lord said to me, tell them, do not go up or fight, for I am not among you, lest you be defeated before your enemies. So I spoke to you, yet you would not listen, but rebelled against the command of the Lord, and presumptuously went up to the mountain. And the Amorite who dwelt in that mountain came out against you and chased you as bees do and drove you back from Seir to Hormah. Then you returned and wept before the Lord, but the Lord would not listen to your voice nor give ear to you. So you remained in Kadesh many days, according to the days that you spent there. It's funny that he talks about the Amorites here and the Canaanites, saying that they came out against them and chased them like bees. I mean, this is funny to me because I remember a situation where I said, all right, when I was working in Takarazuka Higashi High School, and just above Takarazuka Higashi is this big mountain, and it's got all these trails, and I used to look up at the mountain and think, oh, I'd really like to walk up there. And one day I went up there, and I parked my car at the top, and I went in the trail, and I walked along, and there were some beautiful mountain trails, wonderful views of Osaka from the top. You know, and I mean, there was nothing wrong with me doing that, but there at the top of the mountain in summer, or in spring, I guess, there are these things called kumabachi, which are like black, bear bees or bear wasps. They're actually a honeybee, but they're huge, big things. And they look really scary, and they just hang around, kind of flying around in circles above in a certain place. And they were, you know, it looked like a swarm. It wasn't a swarm, but there was a few of them, maybe three or four, just sitting there and doing circles above the track. I mean, these are huge bees, you know, they're far bigger than any bees you would ever see in Australia. They're massive things. That's why they call them bears. And I was like, oh man, what am I going to do? How am I going to get past these bees? At that time, I knew nothing about bees. Well, anyway, I thought, oh, the only thing I can do is kind of try to run past them. But they were so noisy and loud. And eventually I just gripped my teeth, closed my eyes and ran through the middle of them. And I ran for hundreds of meters. And I could swear that I could still hear that buzzing in my eyes. It was like they were right behind me. And even, you know, 100 meters afterwards, I could still hear them. I mean, I think I was imagining it, but I could still hear them, and I was so scared. My heart was racing, and it was a long time before I could stop running. Of course, you know, bees are much faster than a person running, so it was pretty pointless. But, you know, that fear that I experienced at that time. And then as I walked down the hill, you know, another hiker was coming up the hill, and I tried to warn him, and in my poor Japanese at the time, I was like, "Up there, bees, big, black." And the guy is like, "Well, describe it to me." I said, "They're big and black and with a yellow stripe." And he said, "Ah, that's kumabachi." I said, "Oh, yeah?" And he said, "They don't sting." And I was like, "What?" After many, many years, I realized they actually can sting. They're just like a huge version of a honeybee, but they very rarely ever do. And they're quite a harmless, very docile bee. In fact, Yuto's cousin used to caught one and brought it back to our church and was keeping it in a box once, and he used to let it walk all over his hand. So they don't sting. But that fear that I had, it really humbles the pride of a person. Imagine, I'm going to walk up this great mountain, and I'm going to see, you know, all the views, and I'm going to walk, you know, in these mountain paths where I can climb any mountain and overcome any challenge. And then suddenly this bee appears, and this great, proud, you know, explorer just runs and screams and, you know, panics. That's what it's like. You know, we go from 1 second of great pride, and then suddenly we've totally lost control, we're out of our mind, we're panicking, we're in fear. Everything can change in a second. Well, that's the way God humbled the Jews when they presumed to do what God had not instructed them to do. When they presumed even to do what God had told them they couldn't do, even though originally it had been his plan. But he'd changed it, closed the door, and they didn't want to accept it. Sometimes God closes a door for us and we don't want to accept it. And we get so upset and angry. But the reality is, if we try to do what God has not called us to do, it will be like me when I was running away from those bees, totally out of control, totally losing the plot, totally helpless. Now, there's one more scripture to this story, because I just want to see how this ends. Let's go now and look at Numbers 21, verse 3. Can you look at Numbers 21, 3? Okay, Numbers 21, 3. He says here, this is now at the end of their 40 years. Well, let's go back to verse 1. Numbers 21:1. The king of Arad, the Canaanite, who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to Atharim. Then he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. So Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities." And the Lord listened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. So the name of that place was called Hormah. See, in the original scripture that we read, which was before the 38 years of, you know, wandering began, they called it Hormah. But actually, it wasn't called Hormah at that time. It was called Hormah at the end of the 40 years, when God called them to actually go into the land. This time, again, the Canaanites come out. Again, they had a battle. And the Canaanites were strong, but they made a vow to the Lord and vowed to do his will. And he gave them victory and said if they would deliver it to his, and promised if God would deliver it into their hand, they would do as he commanded and destroy the cities that were there. And so they were. They were devoted to destruction. And it was called Hormah. And so this, again, it shows you the beginning and the end. In the beginning, God said, "Go up, because I'm with you. I'll help you." They wouldn't do it. So he said, "All right, plan B. You're not going to go up." Then they tried to go up and were humbled and driven back as far as this place in total defeat. But then when God reopened the door, Even though it didn't make it any easier, they still had to fight, and it was still a hard fight, but God gave them the victory. You see, everything is in God's control, and we have to learn this. You know, don't go on and say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, when you know nothing about what God has coming for us in the next week or day or night or year. We have no idea how things will change. You know, you can make great plans, but who could have predicted a few years ago that Corona would come? Who could have predicted that all the missionaries would suddenly be kicked out of China? When I was there in China, you know, we were there at the universities and somebody's going to do this course and that course and, you know, all these plans we could have made. And then suddenly everyone had to leave. You just can't tell. So we have to be very humble and seek the will of the Lord in whatever we do. We have to pray and we have to acknowledge that God is the one. And, you know, it's not up to us to make it all happen. It's up to us to just listen and carefully follow the will of the Lord, watching for the open doors, watching for the closed doors, and always accepting the constraint that God puts upon us. All right. So, what are we supposed to do? Well, this is the next part of it. If you look back, let's go back to James 4 and look at the last verse, right? So he's gone on and he's saying we shouldn't, you know, say we're going to do this and that, and we should say if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this and that. Verse 16, but now you rejoice in your boastings, all such rejoicing is evil. And then he comes to the advice. Therefore, to him that knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. I always wondered, like, this doesn't just, it doesn't seem to connect. What's the connection there between verses 13 to 16, which kind of were clear as once said, and then verse 17? It seemed, always seemed to me like a totally different teaching. You know, I mean, Jesus talks about people who knew the master's will but didn't do it, they'd be beaten with many stripes or whatever. But what has this got to do with, you know, boasting about plans? But think about it. Therefore, in other words, because of the evil there is in boasting about great plans, therefore, to him that knows to do good and does not do it, it is sin. What he's doing is he's getting it back to perspective. He's saying, you have before you already a plan that God has given you. And if you don't do that, it's sin. Because what happens is, while we're busy making these great plans, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, I'm going to travel to this town and that town and do business and make money, while we're doing all that, we're not actually thinking or concentrating or focusing upon the things God has already revealed to us. The things God has already revealed to us, or the things that he wants to reveal to us, his good and perfect will. And we may not yet know that, but we're supposed to be waiting for it. To him that knows to do good, to do God's will, and does not do it, to him it is sin. Maybe God has arranged for you to have a few years of being humble. Or maybe God's arranged for you to go to, you know, basic training camp, you know, and learn some basic lessons in life before he allows you to go off and do these great things. Or maybe God has a different plan for you and he wants you to be patient and learn how to be patient and wait. But if we don't accept what God has given to us today and do that, it's sin. Because instead of accepting what God is doing, has given to us today, we go off and do other things. I find myself like this a lot. You know, here we've got... you know, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to, you know, build a roof in the back, but before it's finished, I want to start building something else. And before that's finished, I want to start making something else, you know. And eventually, you just get 15 unfinished projects, and everything's a mess, and you find yourself in a dilemma. Whereas, it would be better just to finish the one you're doing before you go on to the next one, all right? Now, that is all within our own plan and whatever, but it's the same within the kingdom of God. God has a job for us to do, and it is to learn to be humble, to learn to give, to learn to worship him and pray and trust him, to learn to forgive others. You know, there are many things that God has. These are great works that God has for us to do, but often we don't focus upon them because we've got these other plans in our mind about great works that we want to do. Therefore, it's sin because we're not focusing on what God has given us to do. I remember when I was a student teacher, I had a very humbling experience. I've shared this before, but it's something that was very real in my life. I was, you know, in the final year of university, you get to go for, I forget how long it was, maybe 3 weeks or something, or a month, to a school and practice teaching. And during my time at the school, I thought, yeah, I'm great. I've had experience speaking in front of people before. I'll have no problem. And it was all right for the first few weeks or first couple of weeks. But then there came a point where I said to the head teacher, oh, I'd like to go and watch, you know, the boys' soccer team play. You know, I thought this would be fun. This is another part of teaching, getting to know the students, getting on with them. And the teacher kind of gave me a funny look, and the head teacher, and said no. And then he said, no, you need to make a lesson plan for our next lesson. I was like, what? You know, why not? You know, I've done all that. But then our head teacher at the university, we had he called all of the people after calling the head teachers at the school and, you know, to have a chat, how's things going? And he said, you know you're failing, right? Like the other teacher was wondering whether to fail you or not. And my university coordinator said, oh, just fail him if you think that he's not doing well enough. And suddenly I realized I was in a great danger. You know, that would have potentially cost me another year of university. A year of, you know, just for the sake of failing the prac teaching. And I had no idea. I was totally blind to the fact that in the head teacher's eyes, my lesson plans were not prepared. I was not treating the lesson planning seriously. I thought I was. And probably he had been trying to explain to me how I wasn't, or maybe how it wasn't good enough, or maybe he just was hoping that I would do better and I wasn't. But anyway, I may as well blame myself, because I suppose he was probably trying to tell me, but I wasn't listening. I guess that's the reality of it. And I was in great danger of failing, and I didn't even know it. And here I am thinking about, you know, the soccer match and all this, and the head teacher wants me just simply to learn how to make a proper lesson plan. You know, I wasn't paying attention to the things I was supposed to be practicing, because I had my head filled with these great ideas that I wanted to do. So God's more concerned with what he's teaching us, the simple little things he's teaching us, than he is with our great ideas. Let's pay attention to what God brings to us each day. It's amazing, you know. We can so easily think that these little things are not important, when in fact they are most important. And ultimately, we get offended because our will is at stake. We don't want to submit our will to God. This is what it comes down to. We are strong-willed people, and we want to do what we want to do, and we don't want to let anyone else tell us what to do. And if they try to tell us what to do, or if we feel forced to do something we don't want to do, oh, we get so upset. We have such strong wills. But to be a Christian is to submit your will to the will of God. Not my will, but thy will be done, is the basic principle of our relationship with God. Like Jesus, the prophecy said, it is in the volume of the book it is written, I have come to do thy will, O God. The prophecies were written about me, the great works. What was it that I've come to do? Your will. And sometimes Jesus' will was that he didn't have power to heal. And sometimes God's will was that Jesus was humbled and beaten. And sometimes God's will was that he was rejected even by his family. Sometimes God's will was that he spent many years just quietly learning. You know, God is the one who mapped out his ministry, and he did the will of the Father. And we have to do the same. But let me just say this. Isn't it a funny thing that we think it's such a bad thing to submit our will to someone else? Imagine this. What's more exciting than a roller coaster? You know, you have absolutely no control of that thing. Once you're locked in, you can't get out, luckily. And you can't change course. You can't speed up. You can't slow down. When it goes down, you're going to go down. When it goes around, you've got to go around. And when it goes upside down, you're going to be upside down. And you've got no control. And the whole thing is mapped out from beginning to end. And yet, people will line up for hours to get on that thing, just for a few minutes of fun. They're terribly exciting, even though we have absolutely no control over what happens. And yet, they're great. Everyone loves them. Well, not everyone. Some people get sick. But, you know, people wish they could ride them even. Or a movie, you know, we all like watching movies, right? But we have no control over the movie. The whole thing is decided from beginning to end. We can't stop the hero making all these mistakes that put him into such a bad situation. We can't stop the villains getting away with murder and getting away with their selfish acts. We can't do anything about it. And sometimes there are movies where good people die. We can't stop it happening, and yet we'll still watch the movie. And we enjoy the movie, and we'll go and watch another one. Why? Because it doesn't matter that it doesn't go according to what we would have it done. It's just exciting because the director was great, or the engineers who designed the roller coaster were great. What's more exciting, a rally through, you know, an unpredictable mountain forest track, or a nice easy drive through the suburbs where you can choose every street you go down? You know, all right, it's nice to do both maybe, but that doesn't mean the rally is not exciting. The rally is exciting. The fact that you don't know what's coming around the next bend makes it exciting. So think of life like that. You may have no choice. You don't need a choice. God may have determined everything from beginning to end. All right, just go with the flow. Go with God's plan. When the door closes, stop. When the door opens, go. You know, you can think about what might be and make preparations if you think it looks like something's going to happen, but always have the attitude, if the Lord wills, I will live tomorrow, if he wills. And if it's his will, if I understand his will correctly, I might do this or that. Let's see what happens. You can have the same plans. You can have the excitement without the pride. It is possible. And that's what we should do. We should recognize our days are like smoke. Smoke may look thick, but, you know, within a short time the winds blow and it's drifted away, dissipated, and we can't even see it anymore. That's what our life is like. But we have a hope that God will take us through to eternity if we fulfill his will. Not our own, but his will. So let's deal with this attitude in us. Don't assume you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And be careful when we talk about what we're going to do. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do this ministry, I'm going to do that ministry. Well, maybe. Let's just be humble in our speech, humble in our planning, humble in our mind, and always ready to give God the say and the control in our life to determine what we will do. I'm hoping that God will open this door. Maybe he has another plan. It's totally different when we have that attitude. But then we can be humble enough to hear the will of God and do it. Let's pray. Father God, I thank you so much for your word. Please, Lord, lead us according to your will and help us to live according to your will. Help us to submit our will to yours. Lord, they were devoted to you in their sin. You took them and made them live in Kadesh, the place that was devoted to holiness in God, and Korma, the place that was devoted, set aside to you. Lord, ultimately, it's all in your plan. It's all in your hand, and we are devoted to you. If you say stop, we'll stop. If you say go, we'll go. Please, Lord, help us to submit to your will and be excited about your will, because you are great, and you are wise, and you are wonderful. Thank you so much. In Jesus' name, amen.